Hey, it's Francis. You know, last year I got turned on to a fascinating book called Eating to Extinction about rare foods that might be going extinct. And so we got to the author, Dan Saladino, and talked about it. Here's that episode.
I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Okay, do this for me, will you? Close your eyes and picture a banana. You see the color, you see the shape, the size in your head. All right, so there are over 1,000 varieties of bananas that exist on this planet, but you almost certainly just pictured the very same variety of banana as every other person listening to this show. Because of those 1,000 varieties, exactly one of them makes over 99% of the bananas that you find in grocery stores. It's called the Cavendish. And, you know, if you like bananas, you like the Cavendish. But what if I told you that there are bananas that taste like apples? Or bananas that are pink? Or bananas that will literally melt in your mouth when you bite them? Like, you'd want to taste those, right? The thing is, the banana is only one of the most extreme examples of how food around the world has lost its diversity. And that doesn't just mean that, you know, we'll just have FOMO for not getting to taste cool things. It also means that that puts, in many cases, our food system and maybe even our own health at risk. You know, like just how people say, you know, diversifying is the key to investing your money, biodiversity is how ecosystems protect themselves and evolve on our planet. But so much of our industrial food supply has been about cutting down, like getting rid of biodiversity in favor of controlling the variables, right? So the grower always knows exactly how big this banana gets and how long it takes to ripen and all the rest of it. Well, Dan Saladino is a journalist in the UK, and he's just written a fascinating, surprisingly fun book called Eating to Extinction. It's a big treasure trove of stories about dozens of foods, some plants and animals, and some culinary traditions that are on the verge of being lost. But he shares what good they can do if we were to embrace them. Hey, Dan. It's great to talk with you.
And you, Francis. Really great to be on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for coming. Well, you know, this book is, I mean, the breadth of stories in this book is just incredible. But, you know, one thing I was really struck by in the very beginning was how you make the case that, you know, the global menu of ingredients has really become so small. You have this really stunning figure that of the 6,000, I think, or so plant species that humanity has eaten over time, we pretty much get most of our calories now from just 9. Mm. And almost 50% of the world's calories come from literally 3 plants. So it's really, really shrunk. And actually, first, let's start from your interest and how you got into it. What sparked your interest in the disappearance of culinary and biodiversity?
Mm. Well, back in 2007, I'd started making radio programs about food for the BBC, and I started to travel. And quite quickly, as I was delving into these different food cultures in different places, I was being told by farmers, by cooks, by food producers that this was the last of this, or this was the harvest this year, but it might not happen again next year. And so I started to become aware that I was visiting foods that might not be around for much longer. More importantly, I then was introduced to an online catalogue that had been created by the slow food movement based in Italy. I was in Sicily. I was recording a programme about oranges. It was around the volcano Etna, where they grow blood oranges. And it was one of those instances where the farmers were saying, well, we're going to leave the fruit on the trees next year because of the cheaper, more abundant citrus that was coming in from Spain and from North Africa. And they said they were trying to get their fruit onto this catalogue, this online catalogue called The Ark of Taste. I looked at the catalogue and realised there were thousands of different endangered foods in the catalogue from 130 countries. And I spent the next 10 years or more trying to witness and taste and meet the producers of as many endangered foods as I could. And that resulted in the book.
But what is causing these foods to be endangered? And obviously, like you said, there are thousands of these foods, so there are thousands of individual stories. I can't expect that they're all explained by one thing, but what are the big picture forces you see creating these endangered foods?
Yeah, and in a way, that's why the book ended up being so long, you know, kind of almost 400 pages, because you're absolutely right that there are more than 30 specific foods profiled in the book, and each one is a lens not only on our food history, but also the reasons why I'm arguing that, you know, this homogeneity is spreading around the world. So, for example, it starts off talking about wild foods from indigenous food cultures, and I talk about foods that can be found in Australia and East Africa, the foods of hunter-gatherers. And in that instance, there are cases of colonialism going back centuries. So, you know, the British arriving in Australia, the arrival of pastoralists and farmers displacing hunter-gatherers. Then I move on to other issues such as the Green Revolution, which in part is a success story because in the middle of the 20th century, the use of science and technology in modern plant breeding enabled farmers to have new varieties of wheat and maize and barley and many other crops, rice as well, high yielding and super abundant in terms of the calories they could produce. So successful, in fact, that they displaced so much diversity around the world. And with that, we lost flavors. We lost resilience because of the variation in these crops and the traits that are able to deal with drought, for example, or diseases. So we really went for yield and we missed out so much more. And I think that's one of the big stories in the book, is that complexity of nature and our interaction with nature as we grow food. We went for a reductionist approach. We went for high input, high yielding, but we lost so much more. And so I explore the reasons why that's a problem for the future, but also why at a cultural level or for reasons of identity, we are also becoming impoverished. You know, it's the same thing with fashion and language and music and cinema. As the sameness spreads around the world, the same has happened with our food. But obviously, I would argue that food is far more important than most of those things. All of those things.
I mean, I love that you bring up the Green Revolution because it's a good example of how complex it is, not just in terms of the situation and you know, all the forces to go into, but just how, like, our understanding of how things happen has to be complex, right? It's not a simple good and evil story. The Green Revolution, you know, like you said, allowed industrial agriculture, which, you know, at the time was not a bad word. Mm. At the time, it was a savior of humankind from hunger, right? We can produce enough food to feed a growing population in a way at a scale that we never thought was possible. And at a efficiency and you know, we made food cheap so that, you know, people didn't have to spend, or at least, you know, not everyone on earth had to spend all of their waking time essentially trying to get enough food to eat. But then that, you know, the one of the side effects of that is that, as you say, like, just to use some of the figures that you bring up in the book, now pretty much all the world's seeds are controlled by four companies. Half of all the cheese in the world is made by the culture sold by one company. You know, things like that, where you have this incredibly monopolistic control. But you also note something really interesting was that in, I think in 2019, like the CEO of maybe Unilever or one of these mega food corporations.
It was Danone. So, yeah, one of those really big global companies that is equivalent to, definitely equivalent to Unilever. Danone, a dairy company. And in New York in 2019, he gave a speech at a UN climate summit and said that we have reached the end of this system, that we have lost so much diversity that we have now created a food system full of risk.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if it doesn't take a whole lot of ruminating to start to see why biodiversity is important. Mm. Right. If you have everything concentrated in a few different species, well, once you have a weakness, a vulnerability, a disease or something, you can knock out, you know, all the world's rice, all the world's corn, so on and so forth. So you need that biodiversity in general as a precept. But one thing that really opened my eyes in this book, and this is getting into one of the specific stories you have, I'd love to hear more about, is that one of the ways that decreased biodiversity affects us, that we're only really starting to understand, is how it also affects the diversity of microbes in our own bodies.
Mm.
Right?
Absolutely.
And
that's
something you say that we can actually taste. One of the examples that I'd love to hear you talk about is, tell us about the flavors of Salé cheese.
Mm.
We're talking with Dan Saladino, author of Eating to Extinction. We'll be back with him for that story of that French cheese in a minute, so stick around. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to BBC journalist Dan Saladino today. He's the author of Eating to Extinction, and he's traveled the world researching foods that we may be on the verge of losing. So before the break, I asked him about one of the stories in his book that illustrates how decreased biodiversity relates not only to our food supply, but also to the diversity of microbes in our bodies. It's a story of Salé, a traditional French cheese. Here's Dan.
It's a story full of complexity. And what I was trying to resist in the book is to try and say, you know, there are baddies in the system and it's all the fault of this particular part of the food system and everything else is good. Or no, I think everything is so much more complex and needs explanation, and which is why I've delved into the deep history of things. And with the Salers cheese, it also helped me understand, why do we have cheese in the first place? I've loved telling the origin stories of these foods, and the idea that when farmers started to domesticate wild grasses and gave us wheat and barley and maize and rice, and then they also domesticated a small number of animals as well as sources of food. Well, not just sources of food, but actually, you know, again, a really complex relationship. The idea that humans could then leave the parts of the world in which they could grow wheat and venture into high altitude mountainous areas. But with these animals, they could capture the energy in pasture given by the sun, which would then be consumed by these animals who would then give milk, which, with the use of microbes, could then be preserved in solid form as energy in the form of cheese, was mind-blowing. And you're thinking, well, based on that process, cheese changes the world. It means you can venture into remote areas where you can't grow those crops and with livestock survive, live, settle. And then end up with a delicious food. Salers is also fascinating because it's one of the most ancient cheese-making techniques still in existence. And again, this is quite a high altitude in roughly the centre of France, where farmers leave their villages during the spring and the summer, and they take their cattle into the richest pasture where they then go and live in huts to make the cheese up in the mountains. And very little is required with the milk to start the coagulation process because it's so rich in microbes, because the pasture is so rich that they don't need a starter culture. The milk goes into a wooden vat, which itself is rich in these microbes that then starts the process of lactic acid fermentation. And off we go. And it's quite a risky ride in terms of what you end up with when it comes to flavour. Some people have described it as, you know, kind of a wonderful, you know, a cheese that will take you into the richness of the pasture. Other people have tasted Salers where it's obnoxious and almost uneatable. But the important thing is that transfer of microbes from the environment in which the cattle are feeding and the breed, which is the Salers cow, and also the milk, this microbial rich milk, becomes the cheese which we ingest, which feeds our gut microbiomes. And this is an emerging science, but the idea that the more diverse our gut microbiome, so the trillions of bacteria and fungi, is beneficial to our physical and mental health. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that again, I mean, so threading through the book is the story of this co-evolution between us and plants and animals and microbes, and Salers is one of the rare examples where that's still intact, but there's just a handful of producers left.
Yeah. I mean, God, there's so much there to unpack, right? First of all, is this idea that cheese is not a food simply to be made and enjoyed, but cheese is really energy from the sun, which is stored in plants, digested by cows, you know, to produce milk that we can then introduce to the microbial world and come out with delicious food that we can eat that nourishes us. So it's a way of harvesting energy from the sun.
Absolutely.
Through these cows, which is amazing.
It is amazing. And you think about the cycles as well of the abundance of spring and summer. And then they would take these solid cheeses. In the case of Salers, they are giant truckles of cheese, so big wheels of cheese. Take them down to the villages where they would then go for the dark winter. And when all the other food had run out, the cheese was there, ready to be eaten. Solid energy.
Yeah. Who are the people making this cheese today?
Well, they live near the village of Salers in France. And I think that the people who are making it in the traditional way, and when I say that, Salers is not only a cheese, it's a breed of cattle and it's a place. It's an extremely physical process as well. So actually the pressing of the cheese high up in the mountainous area, and obviously that, you know, you can't really take huge amounts of equipment with you up in the high pasture, and they live a monastic, you know, life for several months of the year. And I think I was told that there are less than 20 producers now who are doing it in that way of taking their cattle high up, making it into the mountains, sending it back down again, and using this really physical process of driving out the moisture from the curds. So it's hanging on in there, but only just.
Yeah. Wow. Tell us about how they milk the cows too, because there really is, it's not just about the connection between these people and their land. There seems to be a very special connection between them and these particular cows to the point where they're like nestling their own heads into the cow's sides as they're milking them.
Absolutely. And I think it's a clue into the past as well about the relationship between humans and animals. And interestingly, Salers isn't that far from some of the oldest cave paintings in the world. depicting animals such as the ancestors of the cattle. And it's almost as if physically the Soler's cow resembles some of those cave paintings. So they're very...
What do they look like?
Kind of high-backed and you could see almost their bone structure and with horns as well. Almost they look like bison, but, you know, smaller in size. And I've seen this practice in other parts of the world as well, so in a remote part of Turkey. But the cow will not give milk unless it's accompanied by a calf. And, you know, obviously that was the natural order of things as well. And in the modern system where calf and cow are separated, you know, very soon after birth. In the Soler's milking system, the farmer has to reintroduce the calf to the cow, and the calf will be given one of the portions of the milk, and then the farmer will take the rest. So it's almost like a deal's being struck between cow and calf and human. Well, that's my way of looking at it. But and also they will put a bit of salt on the head of the calf as well, so the mother will lick, you know, the head of the calf, and basically just this nurturing process where they are relaxed and the milk is flowing. And that's the way it works in the Soler's process of cheesemaking. But I think that is actually very much part of ancient milking systems wherever you look in the world. And also the fact that they will clean the teats as well with straw. There's no chemicals used because they do want to keep the microbes intact, because everything is in balance in that system.
Yeah. I love that idea of encouraging... I don't want to anthropomorphize too much, but essentially encouraging affection between mother and calf, for the mother to lick the calf's head, and then, you know, that gets the milk flowing.
They are still domesticated animals, and obviously, clearly, there is an extremely powerful human intervention there. But I think so many of the foods I describe in the book, they are in greater harmony with nature, and I think that's a good illustration of how that manifests itself in terms of livestock, farmers and animals.
Yeah, and I love in the book you write how all of that complex relationship between the microbes and the milk and the processes creates unique flavor. There's another interesting story in the book, well, many, but another one I'm thinking of about flavor. And you write about what might be the original citrus fruit, which can be found in Northeast India, and to our taste would be extremely sour and bitter. Talk about that fruit and what it can teach us.
Well, this is in a region of Northeast India called Meghalaya. It is one of the world's biodiversity hotspots. It's quite close to the Himalayas and borders with Southwest China and Myanmar. And The citrus genome has only recently been mapped in the last few years, and everything seems to point back to this region as the center of origin for all citrus. And the wild citrus there, it weaves into all areas of life. So the citrus is medicine. It's also part of ritual as well. So when a child is born, the umbilical cord is placed upon one of the wild citrus trees, and it's almost as if the life of the child, who then becomes an adult, is working in parallel with the life of the tree as well. So a really important tree and fruit to the Khasi in the Garo tribe as well, in the Garo Hills. And there's also a cultural appreciation of this extremely sour and bitter fruit, which it has disappeared from most of the world's palates. What's fascinating there is to think about the science of that, because the reason why these oranges are bitter tasting is because that's part of the plant's defense mechanism. And also there's a lot of science that points to bitterness and the chemical compounds that create bitterness being beneficial to our health as well. And so, you know, this idea that these wild fruits were then taken around the world over many, many centuries, and then ingenious fruit breeders took them and then, you know, made them bigger, in some cases made them seedless, but in most, pretty much all cases, made them sweeter and sweeter. And as the bitterness disappears, the fruit becomes fragile to pests and diseases. And so what do? We actually then have to be the defense system for the plant, and we spray them with chemicals. Exactly. Yeah.
Actually, I had a chance to visit the University of Florida a few years ago. And, you know, I was talking to people who study citrus there. And this is reflected in your book as well. There is essentially this citrus blight that is going around the world that has wiped out billions and billions of dollars worth of Florida citrus, and may, in fact, has the potential to actually wipe out oranges as we know them.
Yeah. And again, when I set out to write the book, and I it could have been a beautiful coffee table book in which I'm profiling all these endangered foods, but I wanted to write a book where I'm saying these endangered foods are inheritance after thousands and thousands of years of farming, has a value beyond just thinking about these wonderful cultures. Aren't they quaint? They're a thing of the past. I wanted to make sure that I was explaining that these were resources for our future as well. And that citrus greening disease, or HLB, as it's called, has devastated the citrus industry. And now they are looking around the world at some of the wild ancestors of citrus. And I think one of the candidates is the citrus that I looked at in Northeast India. But also there are finger limes in Australia, where they have found the traits needed with greater resistance. It doesn't mean that the finger lime of Australia is completely immune from this disease, but it offers greater resistance. And that's the story that threads through so many of these foods, that the variation, all the varieties that exist, all the different traits beyond flavour and colour and appearance are ones that we need because they give us options. And I think the citrus story, and famously the Cavendish banana, are really powerful ones to show us that things are far more fragile than we appreciate.
Right. All you need is one weakness in the armor, and it can be all done for.
And I think the banana story is well known, but I think it's just fascinating to think that the fungal disease that's devastating so many Cavendish monocultures around the world, that fungal disease, Panama disease as it's known, or TR4 currently, co-evolved in parts of Asia where the banana was first domesticated. And it was almost like as the banana was evolving, so was the fungal disease. But we extract the Cavendish from that evolutionary process, and then we clone it. No surprise that the fungal disease, which continues to mutate and evolve, can outrun the Cavendish. And therefore, we end up in a situation of extreme vulnerability.
Yeah, and the Cavendish banana it's almost funny to talk about the Cavendish banana, because 99.999% of every banana you've ever known is a Cavendish banana. The Cavendish banana is the banana for most people, but there are actually thousands of varieties of bananas.
Yeah, 1,500, I think. Yeah. And interestingly, I spotted in a British supermarket the other day a red banana, and I need to do a bit of investigation in terms of where it's from and whether it's just a modern variation of the Cavendish. But it struck me that for the first time in years, I'd seen a different banana in a supermarket in Britain. That intrigues me. So it's happening. I think diversity is coming back.
Now we have two bananas. Okay, let's go to another one, and this one's going to hurt, because we're going to talk about coffee. Obviously something literally billions of people enjoy and maybe even need in their daily lives, right? But that's also super vulnerable to climate change. Because coffee, as it's farmed today, really only grows in a pretty narrow band of climate. And there is a very short, disturbingly short, I have to say, story in the book about someone looking for a lost coffee species that might be able to survive in a changed climate.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's just one of those. As a coffee lover, to understand that Arabica is, again, there's fragility there as a plant, but also.
So Arabica is the coffee that and Robusta are basically the two varieties that most people drink.
So, well, it's important to note that Arabica and Robusta are just two of more than 100 different types of coffee that can be found around the world. Some of them we wouldn't want to drink. Some of them don't have high levels of caffeine. But for reasons of history and trade, and obviously importantly, flavor as well, Arabica became you know, the first coffee to spread around the world, but an extremely narrow genetic type of Arabica spread around the world. When disease hits Arabica in the late 19th century, that's when botanists start to introduce Robusta as a commercial type of coffee. However, with climate change particularly, Arabica looks vulnerable because too much variation in temperature will mean that it is prone to disease, it becomes weak, it doesn't produce as much, or the quality falls. So there's a guy in the UK, a botanist called Aaron Davis, who works at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, which has been collecting endangered plants for 300 years. So it has one of the biggest collections. He travels, I mean, what a job. He travels around the world in search of the other types of coffee. So the 100 plus types of coffee beyond Arabica and Robusta. And he ended up being invited by the government of Sierra Leone to see if he could find a coffee that had once been grown commercially up until the 1960s, but was thought to have gone extinct. And it's called Stenophylla. And he trekked through Sierra Leone into the forests where there were reports of it last existing. And after a couple of weeks, found one tree, which was like finding one single panda bear, because unlike Arabica, which can self-pollinate, Stenophylla needs another tree to reproduce and produce the beans.
Oh, God, no.
So he had to do even more trekking, and luckily...
Oh, the bachelor. He found the bachelor coffee tree. Yeah, so
he found a partner for this other tree. And in 2020... it was the first time in almost 50 years that somebody had tasted a cup of Stenophylla coffee. And there was a tiny, tiny amount. But they are now working on a program where Stenophylla can be brought back as a commercial coffee and creates more of a safety net in the event of, in the decades to come, that Arabica becomes vulnerable. And you described the impact of that disease on the citrus in Florida. The same thing happened in the Americas with Arabica. Huge amounts of a disease called rust spread through. Farmers, you know, lives were kind of devastated. We saw huge amounts of migration from some of the coffee growing areas in the Americas as well. And so Stenophylla could be a part of the future of coffee if they can bring it back at a commercial level, because it actually has greater resistance to disease than Arabica.
Mm. And all from those two trees they found, that would be...
Absolutely.
Let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope. Yeah. And let's look forward to tasting it as well. I'm curious. I haven't tried it myself, but yeah.
We'll have more with BBC food journalist Dan Saladino, author of Eating to Extinction. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking with Dan Saladino from the BBC, author of the book Eating to Extinction, about the foods we're on the verge of losing and why we want to keep them around. Let's get back to it. So Dan, over, you know, 400 pages of book, 400 pages of stories, meeting farmers, you know, traditional craftspeople, all these people who are preserving these foods. Is there someone who really stands out to you? Who, like, there's someone you can't forget? Someone who really, you know, really just lives in your memory?
There is, and actually it's the only character in the book who features in both the introduction and the epilogue, and it's one of the Hadza hunter-gatherers. He's called Zigwadzi, and he took me out into the savannah, and I watched him whistle, and a bird swoop down and take him to a tree where there was honey. And
come on.
And it was a conversation between a human and a bird. Both want the honey. The bird can't safely get to the honey because of the swarming, stinging bees. the human, Zigwadzi in this case, has fire and smoke. So once he is shown where the honey is by the bird, and there are these baobab trees that are across the savannah. So to actually find the bee's nest is a big challenge, could take hours. The bird can quickly take the hunter to the tree, climbs up, and then what I watched was Zigwadzi up there taking a few stings, but throwing down handfuls of honey to his friends below, gorging themselves on this honey. It's their number one favorite food, crunching on the bees in the honey and also the larvae. So it's a combination of carbohydrate and protein. And again, that could be, it's possible. I mean, this is in a part of the world where there are the oldest human footprints ever found. And some of our, some of the human ancestors have been excavated as well, you know, in terms of deep archaeological history. It could be that relationship that I was watching is one of the fundamental things that made us human.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I have heard about this idea that the ability to find honey was key to human evolution. Right,
yeah.
In that that actually gave us a huge store of calories for our brains to evolve.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, like, we would just never had the energy to evolve brains that take so much energy.
And meat does get so much attention. One argument is because the fossil record shows us the hand axes and the stone weapons used. Honey gathering has left very little evidence in the archaeological record. So I think it there is a very solid argument that it was actually honey that made us human.
Yeah. So bringing it back to this gentleman who showed you this honey, did he offer some for you to taste?
He did. Yeah. Yeah. He also gave me some porcupine liver as well. I mean, he went deep underground through tunnels where porcupine live, and to find where they were so he could dig them out and then slaughter and then take the meat back to his camp. And so what I actually saw with Zigwadzi was incredible skills of how to feed a community. And for those few days I was with him, I felt extremely safe because, again, from the use of poison arrows to climbing up trees and finding honey to digging out porcupine, skills that our ancestors had an abundance that very few of us have now. And there he was, somebody who could just survive with nothing in this environment.
Yeah, and an understanding of how humanity fits into its environment, in its ecology. Amazing.
And children as young as five actually are almost self-sufficient because of that relationship they have with nature, with animals, with plants. You know, knowing which berries are there, which tubers to dig for.
Yeah. So it's not just the foods that are lost, but the skills, the knowledge, the talents.
Exactly.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis.
Dan Saladino is a food journalist for the BBC and author of Eating to Extinction, the world's rarest foods and why we need to save them. Carlos Baca is a chef, a food activist, and he's the lead writer of A Gathering Basket, which is a cookbook of indigenous foods written to help educate fellow indigenous people on the tastes of native cuisine. He's also at the forefront of saving wild foods like the bear root. So, hey, Carlos, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Francis. How about yourself?
I'm well, thank you. I'm really excited to have you on the show. And I want to talk about bear root, because I read that you wrote that your very first taste memory is of bear root and a little bit of the soil that it grew in. Can you describe that taste and tell us what bear root is?
There's like such a multifaceted answer to that, because the taste in and of itself is directed by where the moon is. And so depending on new moon and full moon, the flavor is completely separate. It's like they don't taste anything like each other.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And on one spectrum, it tastes almost like maple syrup. Mm-hmm. And on the other spectrum, it tastes like maybe like a spicy, almost in the realm of like a light chili.
Oh, wow.
With a touch of sweetness to it. It's hard to describe, but for myself and that first experience, was in a full moon setting, and it was definitely more on the spicy side. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's my memories. That's my grandfather teaching me that medicine, so that's where it's at.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's amazing. So this is a plant that grows for many years. Why does it have that name? Why is it called bear root? And tell us more about this plant and its importance.
Right. So, you know, it takes 10 years to mature.
Okay.
And the reasoning and why it's becoming an endangered being is because of that very length of time it takes to grow. You know, herbalists and folks in that realm go in and wipe out entire ecosystems of it fairly regularly, because it's a lot of work to collect one, you know? And so they go in and they just spend that whole day just annihilating the whole space. And then, you know, that area probably, who knows, you know, maybe it took 90 years to grow and now it's gone. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just, it's really, really interesting. And you know, and the name bear root is like, it's kind of the story of our past interaction with our bear relatives and in watching them. They do this in two different times. Usually when they come out of hibernation, they'll go and dig the root up. And anytime that they are sick, they will go dig this root up. So just in our interaction as humans, watching how they would go, you know, heal themselves in this way. That just translated into us doing, you know, following their lead.
That's incredible. So yeah, when bears are coming out of hibernation, you know, they've just spent 6 months without nutrition. They've spent 6 months, you know, just sort of using their energy and not getting any energy, and using, you know, the, you know, whatever is in their body keeping them going. So if that's what they do when they come out, they know something about this plant. So when you talk about healing with it, what are the properties? What have you used it for? What's been taught to you? What have you learned about it?
Well, from the Western perspective, you know, it's antibacterial. It's antimicrobial. It's one of those few plants that has all the healing properties to it.
Okay.
And two, that also goes back to when you harvest it and what your purposing is in using it. So you can use it, say, as a form of a heating medicine, you know, something that's going to help temperature and like bronchial kind of infection type things. And then on the other spectrum, you're looking more towards stomach. But I've seen it in so many uses. I've seen it used in salves. You know, we use it in steams. You can just chew on the leaves fresh. Definitely harvest them and dry them for tea. You know, my grandfather used to make a tea out of bear root, lemon, onion, and honey.
Is their flavor connected to the flavor of the root?
Oh, it's extra. Yeah, it's like the lighter version. Yeah, it's
so it can be mapley, can be spicy.
Yeah, definitely. And then the seeds, all it's the same, you know. Just looks like a fennel seed, but it maintains that flavor, and also maintains you know, the medicinal properties of the entire plant exist within the entire plant. It's not just the root that, you know, and, but that's not the knowledge that was passed on to the Western side of the herbal community. And so they don't, I don't really, I can't actually say I've ever been into any apothecary that they had the leaves or the seeds there or the stock, you know, and I mean, that says a lot. That speaks to all of it, right? It's just the extrication of that, and then the rest of the plant just goes by the wayside.
And to not know the full knowledge of it means, it also means you're harvesting the part of it that's hardest to grow, right? Like the leaves would come back, and you know, if you're using that, that's a more, you know, this is a tricky word, but it's a little bit more sustainable way to use the plant rather than digging up the root where, you know, it doesn't come back.
Yeah.
So tell me about what you're able to do to help save this special plant.
Well, I mean, I guess the most important of those things is, and especially now more where foraging is trendy, and that more people are going into those spaces attempting to learn and I'll say that in witnessing this, you know, even over the last 20 years, it's just been on like this steady incline, is that most people, they have no, at least no understanding of what it means to be part of the landscape. And whenever you are out tramping through the forest, and all those weeds that you just step on and just push over, you know, like those are typically medicine plants, you know? So I see that a lot. I just see them like trampled. And it's really, really disheartening to see. I guess one, you have to know that they only exist in a symbiotic relationship with a very specific forest type. And they don't grow anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
You can't cultivate it. Although there are varieties that you can. There are, I think, three different varieties of it. Two of them are cultivatable, but not the one that has the most, you know, that's the strongest. And so I guess I always teach you, like, moving the ecosystem. That's like what our ancestors did. I call it like cultivation in motion, because as an indigenous people that moved a lot, you know, they had like a cycle of going up and down the mountains. That was how it worked. You know, like science is starting to recognize that the Pacific Northwest was cultivated, right? Like the indigenous people actually built that whole entire ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the same down in the Southern Hemisphere, right? Like those are, and that's relevant here. It's the same conversation.
Yeah, just because it doesn't look like, you know, neatly rowed, you know, fields doesn't mean it wasn't cultivated, doesn't mean it wasn't impacted by people and their knowledge and their skills and their understanding of what that ecosystem is.
Definitely.
And, you know, how they can interact with it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So it sounds like, I mean, if the threat, among other things, and, you know, also there's environmental degradation and colonialism, but the direct threat to something like bare root is folks will only understand one part of the story, coming in and taking it all and leaving. And what you're saying is it's as much about humans' interaction with the ecosystem and how they affect it and how it affects us and understanding the whole picture rather than, oh, that's the thing we need, well, let's go get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll say it like this. This is the way that I always represent it, because I think that the extrication of man from its place of being has obviously, you know, been the destruction point of this entire planet. And the easiest way to put it is that you have to Like the same way that you would treat your lover is the same way that you need to behave with your environment, because it's that important to nurture that space in the same way that you nurture the relationship between you and your children, between you and your partner.
Yeah.
And to be, you build an entire ecosystem right there, right? That's what you're doing. And the extrication of humanity from environment, you know, is that displacement. That's the point of displacement. And so you really have to go into those spaces with that understanding, right? Like you don't exist without that.
Yeah.
Like you are that being, right? And it's all like the state of the world is a reflection of us.
Right. That's really well said. Thank you so much, Carlos.
Yeah, thank you.
Carlos Baca is the founder of Taste of Native Cuisine, and his book, Made with the Eye Collective, is called A Gathering Basket. So that's our show for the week. Thank you as always for listening. And for more on endangered foods, a good resource is The Arc of Taste, the project of Slow Food. Talk to you next week, and we're going to get back to your cooking questions. So if you have any for us, record them as voice memos on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.